Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. Hello and welcome to Material Girls, a pop culture podcast that uses critical theory to understand the zeitgeist. I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Marcel Cosman. And this week we have a brilliant guest joining us. Karen Tongson is professor of gender and sexuality studies, English and American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. She is the author of Why Karen Carpenter Matters, and Relocations, Queer Suburban Imaginaries. She also co-hosts the podcast Waiting to Exhale and The Gaymazing Race. Her newest book, Norm Porn, Queer Viewers and the TV That Suits Us, came out in November 2023 with NYU Press and is available now.
Karen, welcome.
Welcome, Karen.
Thanks for having me, everybody. I'm so glad to get a chance to chat with you both.
Thank you for being here.
I'm really excited to talk about Gilmore Girls for a variety of reasons, including my deep emotional attachment to it, and also how much I like watching Marcel struggle to engage when she hasn't watched the thing that we're talking about. But before we dive into Gilmore Girls, I want us to just warm up a little bit. Norm porn is in part about the self-soothing watching habits of queers. So I want to know what everybody's watching to self-soothe right now. Karen, what's your current self-soothing TV watching?
You know, it's funny because one of the things, spoiler alert, about the book is that I make a point about when I think norm porn ends as a subgenre. And so when I recently faced a moment of grief and despair, I was sort of like, what am I going to watch? Oh no, what's left? And to tell you the truth, it's the entire The Traitors franchise from the US to the UK to Australia. It was the only thing that absorbed me, other than watching the Australian Open for some reason, which was sort of soothing with its timed grunts and ball bouncing. The Traitors, Alan Cummings, over the topness, everything that's actually the opposite of what I described norm porn as, became the thing that gripped me. And I'm very sad that I can't get a hold of like the British season two yet because I'm too terrible at VPNs.
Oh, well, if you want me to help you pirate some TV, just let me know. I'm really good at stealing.
For sure. Like, give me more traitors.
Great. Marcel, you've been sick. You've been a sickie. What are you watching?
Well, it's probably not for comfort. I just finished watching the latest season of True Detective, which I really enjoyed, but that's not a comfort. That's not comforting. That's very stressful. The comfort watch is that I'm rewatching The Bear with my partner who's never seen it, and it's allowing me to actually understand what is going on because I watched the entire first two seasons being like, I don't know what's going on, but I'm really into these characters. Why are they doing this? Why is there... Why do they have so many cans of tomato sauce on the floor? I don't understand.
So you're really able to dig into the tomato sauce-based plot twists.
Love to figure out what's going on vis-a-vis tomato sauce.
Man, Marcel, you love stressful TV.
I know. I don't know why.
I'm just rewatching old seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race. The perfect comfort watching. Nothing has ever been so artificial and self-contained in the world. Nothing has ever been so simultaneously pleasing and yet profoundly low stakes.
In our first segment, Why This, Why Now?, we ask the materialist question. What are, or were, the historical, ideological, and material conditions for our object of study to become zeitgeisty?
And, as I've already alluded to, our object of study today is Gilmore Girls. So let's start by just talking about our collective relationships to this show. And Karen, I want you to go first. When did you first watch Gilmore Girls? How often do you rewatch Gilmore Girls? Where does the show live in your heart?
I didn't start watching it until probably, I think, midway through its run, when both an encounter with Laura Kipnis and becoming friends with my dear, dear friend, Jennifer Doyle, who lives here in Los Angeles, both of whom are theorists of harassment, shockingly, both had a real attachment to the show. Laura Kipnis mentioned it at a dinner once when she was visiting for a talk at USC. And Jennifer just really loved the show. And I am aligned with a lot of her tastes in other aspects of pop culture. Oh. So I just started watching it and I became hooked. And then suddenly, it was still back in the DVD days, I had to get a hold of all of the DVDs of the previous seasons. Because I was like, wait, what's going on? Because I believe that I entered into the show right when Luke and Lorelai were starting to get together.
Oh, you need multiple seasons of sexual tension to understand that relationship.
So I was like in media res, right? It was really like plopping in the middle and then having to go back and acquire the full, texture and emotional, field of what was happening there. So that's how I first discovered it. It was through recommendations from critical theorists.
Oh, I love that. How appropriate. I watched it when it first came out, and I was almost the same age as Rory when the show launched. Like, I am right at that same age demographic. And I watched it from season one. I think I watched maybe the first two seasons live as they were airing. And the context for my viewing was that my mother, to whom I was extremely close, was dying of cancer and then died during that time. And I have a very vivid memory of watching an episode of Gilmore Girls with her and her turning to me and saying, "Do you wish our relationship was more like this?"
Well,
and me being like, "What a hard question." But I ended up... What an unanswerable question for you to pose to me now. But I didn't make it beyond the first couple of seasons. I think in part because when you're in high school, it's really hard to follow. It was really hard to follow serialized TV because you had to make a commitment to being at a certain place at a certain time to watch the next episode. And that was just something I was not prepared to do at the age of 17. But I revisited it in my undergrad. And that's when I sort of found my way back to it and watched it through on DVD, as one did at the time, and have probably rewatched it three or four times all the way through in the years since, with some selective season skipping at times, depending on how I feel about the various boyfriends. But Marcel, you missed it entirely, didn't you?
I did. So I want to preface this by saying that I am here enthusiastically to play the role of audience who has never seen the show Surrogate. So if you are listening and you're like, I don't know this show, I've never watched it, I'm here with you, man. I'm going to ask all those hard-hitting questions like, who and why?
Wait, what? The main reason why I missed it by choice. I remember it being quite popular. Well, I should say, I remember it being quite popular among the DVD watchers when I was in undergrad, because I didn't have cable, so I couldn't watch it when it was coming out the first time. But when I tried to give it a go, I remember learning that the premise was like this very, very close mother and daughter. And for context, my mom and I have over the years been like extremely, extremely close at various times. And she was a single mom for most of my life. And I also grew up very poor. And so trying to watch the show was really hard for me because they were just so wealthy. And I was like, wow, my relationship with my mom would probably be a lot more fun if we had disposable income. And so I was like really turned off from it. I think I'm a lot less bitchy about shows that I don't get into now than I was at the time. So like I really made a choice to just not involve myself in it, even though it was very popular, because of like, I don't know, like a lukewarm class politics, I guess. Maybe real lukewarm, though, not like certainly didn't translate to shows that I did watch. Do you know what I mean?
Well, can I just say that they try to have the class politics both ways, right? Because Lorelai herself was a single mom,
yeah,
purportedly of the service working classes, who worked at an inn at a desk and didn't have money. But then, you know, she sort of undertakes this project of like pseudo repair with her family,
yeah,
her very wealthy patrician family,
right,
in order to put her daughter through school. So presumably all the fun that Lorelai created was not born of wealth.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of organic fun somehow.
Oh, but her house was so big.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So there's a lot of magical, yes, thinking around that stuff, but
totally. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, also I should say that my mom was 18 when she had me. So I have a, yes, very young mom as well. And my mother also started watching the series. And in much the same way that there was tremendous discomfort around when she like would put the Joy Luck Club on every time she wanted to talk to me about something, she was
every time. Mom.
I called it being Joy Lucked, honestly. But that with Gilmore Girls, she was the one who said, I wish our relationship was more like this, you know? And I was like, wow, there are a lot of reasons that it's not. And I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah. So for the Marcels who are listening right now, Karen, can you give us like a 2-3 sentence summary of like what the Gilmore Girls is before I dive into some historical context?
Sure. A mother-daughter pair living in a small town in Connecticut. A charming town filled with oddballs. Basically, they have a great time. They drink a lot of coffee. They fast talk. They're very, very close. The mom was only 16 years older than the daughter. And the series launches with precisely this problem. The gifted daughter needs the funds to attend a fancy prep school so she could achieve her dream of going to Harvard eventually. And this reopens the relationship between Lorelai Gilmore, the mom, and Rory, named after her. So it's Lorelai the second, essentially.
Oh.
So it reopens the relationship with the patrician older parents with whom she has been estranged essentially since she left and went to the small town of Stars Hollow and had Rory and raised her on her own. And that's my briefest summary of how Gilmore Girls is constructed.
Very impressed. Okay, so this is the segment where we talk about the historical conditions of our object of studies production. But I want us to save a lot of our conversation for the next segment where we're going to dig into the concept of norm porn. So I'm going to keep this on the short side. Here are a few fun facts about Gilmore Girls.
I love fun facts.
It ran from 2000 to 2007 on the WB, which turned into the CW in 2006. So that last season was technically on the CW, but the CW kind of was also the same thing as the WB. I got really bored reading about network relationships, but they're there. And then it returned in 2016 for the miniseries A Year in the Life, which followed up on the characters 9 years later.
It was created by Amy Sherman Palladino, who interestingly got her start as a staff writer on Roseanne.
I loved Roseanne, just saying.
Yeah. And so there's some interesting sort of history of her writing supposedly comedy about working class families. And then later on, as creator of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, she became the first woman to win a Primetime Emmy Award for comedy writing and for directing.
I also love The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Should I try watching Gilmore Girls?
Yes.
Yeah, you should. Yeah, you should be. You're bad. The lore of Gilmore Girls is that the premise, a show about a mother and daughter who are also best friends, was a last-ditch attempt to get the network interested when the rest of Sherman Palladino's pitches had fallen flat, which truly reminds us of how different the landscape was for network television in the late 90s and early 2000s. And it's, Karen, you talk about this in the book, it's a sort of auteur-ish TV series in the sense that Sherman Palladino and her husband Daniel Palladino wrote the majority of the episodes, like a much higher percentage than showrunners will generally write for an ongoing series. And the episodes that they didn't write, they like reviewed very closely because the texture of the show, it's like really characteristic dialogue, pace and patter was really sort of key to what the creators were going for. And apparently, the dialogue was so fast-paced. Famously, the scripts were like 30 pages longer than average hour-long network TV scripts. And apparently Lauren Graham, who plays Lorelai Gilmore, the mom, had to quit smoking so that she could deliver the dialogue at the pace at which it was written.
That's delightful.
The other thing that I want to note is that sort of when people talk about the history of this show, they really do focus on the sheer quantity of dialogue and the way that it sort of evokes the history of screwball comedies. Or culture writer Constance Grady, for example, describes it as having the tone of a, quote, His Girl Friday screwball throwback, end quote. But she also points out that the show has a tendency to use like the sheer quantity of on-screen dialogue to emphasize how many important life events happen off-screen and are never discussed. So to quote Grady again, quote, on Gilmore Girls, the explosion is never what matters. It's the fallout. That's true for the action, and it's also true for the dialogue, end quote, which I just want to acknowledge is incredibly waspy.
Okay, I know that this is just supposed to be some quick fun facts, but can the two of you give me an example of what this means?
Yeah. So one of the forms it takes is that, for example, when there is a huge event like a car crash that is going to like really change the dynamic between Rory and her current boyfriend and how Lorelai feels about said boyfriend, that car crash happens off screen.
Okay.
So like when major events happen, they often happen off screen because the show is much more concerned about playing out the emotional relationships and the emotional fallout of the events than it is about sort of dwelling in the events themselves.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
So this is just some background context, but Karen, we're going to get, as we talk more about norm porn, we're going to get further into the topic of rewatching and revisiting comfort series. But do you have any theories about what made the show so popular in the context of its original airing?
I think that one of the things that made Gilmore Girls so popular in that sort of early aughts moment was that it presented a kind of small town nostalgia that was in line with the kind of national zeitgeist of you know, sort of pulling back from the kind of scattershot liberal urbane, you know, moment of the 90s where everybody was tracking the movement from, especially in young adult TV shows, from, you know, from the country or the suburbs to the city, back to like a quaint snow globe world, as Lorelai describes it. It was also peak Bush era, right? So it was something that was at once family friendly in a way that did not disrupt the national narrative at the time, but also presented a counter narrative through the show's feminist politics, through these spunky Gilmore Girls who were clever and knew a lot about, they had voluminous encyclopedic knowledge about pop culture and culture writ large. Lorelai is an autodidact. There's peak Gen X pop culture referentiality, and to see that playing out with Rory you know, sort of absorbing that and becoming its conduit as a millennial. I think that there's something there that makes it exciting. And also, you know, there was a kind of strange oddball array of quote unquote diverse characters for family programming that included Lane Kim, let us not forget, who is a Korean American character, Rory's best friend, played by Keiko Ajana, and her mother are essentially the shadow pair to Lorelai and Rory, who have a different set of problems, but who mirror within this kind of strangely diverse small town, like an alternate version of, you know, that mother-daughter relationship. And, you know, there's all sorts of strange diversities that appear in this small-ass town in the middle of Connecticut called Stars Hollow, including Lorelai's vaguely homosexual coworker at the first inn that she was working at named Michelle. I guess he's supposed to be French-Canadian. His, you know, frequent references to Celine Dion allude to that fact. And I do think that he explicitly says he's from Quebec or something at some point.
Yeah, I mean, he hates other French people, yeah. So it checks out.
Exactly. So it could be manufacturing that. But all this said, I think that this sort of strange play in the Bush era of, you know, playing with the sort of hometown manufactured small town politics of that era and infusing it with these diverse characters does something to thwart that narrative at the same time that it spoons it up for family TV viewers.
And thinking about it in that context, you know, in the sort of the post 9/11 Bush era, when people were being really fed the, like, we must unite across our differences, really recontextualizes Lorelai's attempt to sort of rebuild her relationship with her parents and, like, Rory's greater success at rebuilding her relationship with her grandparents, because Rory, this like explicitly liberal millennial with like very like, you know, when we encounter her politics, they're pretty left politics. And yet she is incredibly comfortable with her clearly Republican grandparents. Like her grandmother's a member of the DAR.
What's the DAR?
The Daughters of the American Revolution, I think?
Oh, yes. The DAR is essentially like, it's a long-running group. It's very patrician, it's very WASPy. It means that, you know, you are descended from the first settlers of the United States of America, essentially, and that you're very proud of that heritage back to the kind of early American colonial era.
I think the Canadian equivalent is probably the United Empire Loyalist. Where I grew up, there's a lot of pride in being a descendant of a colonizer. So there's like United Empire Loyalist, UELer kind of identification.
I do want to say, in reference to what you were just talking about, Hannah, with this attempt to, you know, have friends in the red states and the blue states coming together, as Obama famously spoke about before he was even running for president at the DNC, is that, spoiler alert, Rory essentially ends up covering the Obama campaign in the final episode of the original run of the series as she runs off to try to achieve her dream. So I do think that there's a real through line to that vision of this kind of, I don't know, like the kind of an America that can get along again and be brought together, but that is deeply comfortable with its economic inequality.
Hmm. Mm. Yeah, I just rewatched the episode where Luke, who is the owner of Luke's diner and the sort of on-again, off-again romantic interest of Lorelai, in the first season in particular, he is the most explicitly politically radical character. Like, he makes reference to America being built on stolen native land. He runs a diner, but he keeps telling people how dangerous both coffee and red meat are. So he's sort of this very like rough and tumble sort of manly dude who's like really woke. And he is really angered by when the men in Stars Hollow gather to reenact a historical quote unquote battle. Because it's a battle that never happened, because it was just 10 men staying up all night waiting for the army to arrive, and they never did. But also, like, explicitly because he's like, we shouldn't be celebrating a war fought by settlers on native land. But then when all of these reenactors are out in the cold and the snow, he like comes out and brings them all coffee. And it's this real like, listen, I think that what you're doing here is fundamentally racist, but that doesn't mean I can't bring you a coffee. And that, I think, really gets at the tone of the politics of this show.
Can I just add one bit of trivia about Luke, though?
Please.
Mm-hmm.
The lore is that initially that role was written for Alex Borstein, who ends up being the Butch manager in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And that Luke was initially going to be somebody not named Luke and a woman with whom Lorelai had this repartee. So which gets enacted in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel later on in Amy Sherman Palladino's oeuvre, right? So there is something about like kind of butch lesbianic identification also that I always have had with Luke in a strange way that that makes sense in the show's crafting. And I don't think that that's just apocryphal. I'm pretty sure that I read that in a trade piece. I may have even cited it, that trade piece in the book. I can't even remember anymore. It's all a blur. But there you go.
That makes so much sense because Luke is absolutely written like a butch lesbian. Uh-huh. Oh my God. Wow. That just made a lot of things come together.
So Karen, we recently did an episode about Twilight. And when we were talking about Twilight with our guest Jackson Bird, we talked about the kind of post-feminist hellscape that was the early 2000s. And so for listeners, post-feminism was the idea that feminism had achieved its ends. And so we no longer needed it as a collective project. And in turn, mainstream feminist discourse then became really fixated on pop culture representations of powerful women. So like Miranda Priestly from The Devil Wears Prada, for example. And individual women's narratives of success, which focused a lot on wealth accumulation and class ascendance for predominantly straight white middle-class women. So I would love to hear from the two of you a bit about reproductive politics in Gilmore Girls, because one of the only two things I know about the show is one, Lorelai was a teenage mother, and then that Rory's best friend ends up getting pregnant at some point in the show. And I only know about that because it was a real bummer, right? Am I right? Is it a bummer in the show? Anyway, could the two of you talk about the reproductive politics? Because I feel like this is very, this feels like very, very Bush era post-feminist kind of stuff.
That's basically the content of the Gilmore Girls chapter in my book. Norm Porn is to revisit its reproductive politics, especially to think about the show in the wake of Roe v. Wade going down here in the U.S., right? And I hadn't thought about it while I was watching the show in real time, which is funny, right? Maybe in part because I had my own mom who had me in 1973, which was the year abortion was made legal, but she was in the Philippines where it was not, okay? And so the feminist plotline of Gilmore Girls revolves around Lorelai's refusal to get married, essentially. But reproductive choice is never a part of that decision-making process, right? It's sort of like, okay, her original act in leaving the family was to have this baby. And kind of like mirroring some of those 80s films, like She's Having a Baby or what have you, right? Like where the teen mom goes ahead and has a baby, doesn't have an abortion. A lot of this has to do with production because it's on a family network. The WB and the CW are explicitly family primetime network broadcast entities. And so there are a lot of different rules and kind of different mores that work themselves out around these brands. But a lot of it also, you know, is the extent to which women in the series seem to be punished for their reproductive freedom in various ways or their sexuality. It's almost like Lorelai is the only one who's allowed to have sex and never again have a kid, whereas Suki, her best friend, who's a chef played by Melissa McCarthy, suddenly becomes almost a baby factory in the series.
Oh, man. It's how they manage having a fat person on screen. It's the only thing that they can figure out how to do with the fact that she's fat. They're like, well, there's no excuse. She has to be pregnant all the time.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. And Lane, after getting married and having sex for the first time on her honeymoon, terrible sex, which is a scene that I focus on in the book, and the depiction of this sex happening in Mexico during a honeymoon is incredibly awful, xenophobic, racist, etc. Yeah. Anyway, ends up being pregnant. And Keiko Ajina has spoken up about the sort of how the series failed her character in particular. And many fans have that feeling. But yeah, I don't want to go too far because I think then we end up with what happens in A Year in the Life, which also has to do with reproductive politics right at the moment of Trump's election in the United States. But which is all to say that the reproductive politics of the series is terrible. And despite the fact that I write about this series as a comfort watch or as, you know, as something that's soothing, this is the focus of what I write about in the book.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, that does seem to be from the book part of the nature of norm porn is that it's got that soothing quality and that also has that quality of like, there's a politics here at work that I, as a queer viewer, must be so, so suspicious of.
Karen, nobody assigned me your book for reading. So could we move into the next segment to talk about it?
I read it without you because I love keeping you in the dark, but I feel like we can probably dig into it a little bit.
Good.
Our next segment is called The Theory We Need, and it's where we introduce some critical theory to help make sense of our topic. Luckily for us, our distinguished guest has just written a whole danged book about our topic, so our theoretical frame today is going to focus on the concept of norm porn. Karen, can you start us off by telling us what norm porn is?
There are two definitions of norm porn. One is very specific and material, and the other is a kind of more general description of a viewing practice. So norm porn is a subgenre of television that I've taken the time to sort of explain. It's sentimental realist television, seen as kind of aesthetically innovative for its time, that begins in the late 1980s with the series 30-something. It's a series about essentially a group of liberal yuppies who are in Philadelphia, who are in their 30s and grappling with the vagaries of everyday life and the sort of collapse of their youthful idealism as they deal with having kids, as they deal with career stress, financial stress, et cetera. And that may sound like every other show you see on television now, but in the 80s, in a world kind of dominated by Dynasty, Dallas, cop shows, doctor shows, again, not unlike what we see on network television now. 30-something felt like most people said it was very cinematic or theatrical because, you know, one might describe it as a little bit mumblecore. It's a little bit whiny. The episode 2 of 30-something is described as Hope is disappointed that her bathroom remodel isn't going to be finished before her in-laws come to town. So basically white people problems, right?
Relatable, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, relatable to me, a professional in their 30s.
Yeah, but which is all to say that, you know, that's the sort of starting point. But I focus on shows in the sort of longer stretch of the millennium that we've had so far, mostly from the Bush era, the Gilmore Girls era, to a show like This Is Us, and about, you know, these series that depict these families that expand themselves through adoption and through other models of kinship to incorporate all forms of diversity, whether or not it's sexual diversity, racial diversity, et cetera, like realist sentimental dramedies that are on network television that accomplish this work. Norm porn, though, is also a viewing practice. So while it describes this really specific subgenre, it also describes how we watch television sometimes, you know, how we watch certain kinds of TV to release our tears. Even as queer viewers who may be avowedly politically radical, you know, it sometimes catches us off guard. Sometimes we begin hate watching Parenthood and then find ourselves reduced to a puddle and hating ourselves or concealing our watching of this show from partners or what have you. And so many, and it all came about because I posted this precise sensation of watching Parenthood. I posted about it back on Facebook back in the day. And so many radical queer folks were just like, I resent every tear it's elicited from my dead cold eyes. And so I wanted to think about that. Like, against our better aesthetic and political judgment, why are we seduced by these depictions of new normalcy, especially in the Obama era?
And that's so interesting. So Karen, similar to Gilmore Girls, I've heard of the other shows that you've named, but I haven't seen any of them. But the way that you're describing the kind of ethos of these shows, it's making me wonder if the same kind of ethos makes its way into sitcoms as well. Like, I grew up watching a lot of sitcoms, and I feel like sitcoms are the sort of thing that I kind of come back to for comfort watching. And so I'm wondering about, like, I don't know, I'm going to name another show that I never watched, The Office, like things that are not dramedies. They're definitely situation comedies, but are supposed to be sort of like relatable to average viewers or some population demographic that's like considered an average viewer. They're like pretty white, but they have like a sort of semi or something diverse cast. Do you see it like sort of seeping into other television genres?
As a viewing practice, absolutely yes, right? So that's why I differentiate between the genre and the viewing practice. That said, people always ask me about Modern Family, which also has sentimental realist aspects to it. But the thing about sitcom as a format is that it is built to be resolved after 30 minutes, whereas these dramedies are not, right? Or like there are these longer story arcs that happen across it. This is why I use in my introduction WandaVision as an interesting entry point to this question, because, you know, the reason Wanda chooses the sitcom format to work through her bereavement is because each episode and, you know, each era presents a sitcom that will tidy up a resolution, even though part of what's happening is that both her affect and the format start to bust at the seams and fail to hold these things, right? So it's sort of about like the relationship between humor, bereavement, et cetera, and about why, you know, the sitcom format becomes the thing that she turns to, and it ultimately can't hold that, right? That's why I'm really insistent on this really specific micro genre of stuff. But in terms of norm porn, you can watch The West Wing as norm porn or Madam Secretary.
I was going to suggest The West Wing.
I call that your civic norm porn. You know, because it's sort of like, because it's sort of like it is, it presents this sort of operational fantasy of an operational government that mirrors one's ideals or liberal ideals, at least, right? They're both really liberal shows. And that's the thing about norm porn is its political orientation is liberal. And one could say neoliberal also, but it is like all shades of liberal, essentially, the full spectrum. Maybe even broaching compassionate conservatism in some ways. Mm-hmm. But it is about the dream that the American family can absorb change, difference, and still keep intact the very notion of family.
Okay. Mm. That's so helpful. Mm. Thank you.
Okay, Karen, you might not know this, but I wrote a whole book about sentimentality a couple of years ago that, like, in some intriguingly overlapping ways, I'm like, trying to work through why I'm emotionally attached to like a lot of media that is sentimental by definition and like what to do with that and the politics of that. And so I'm wondering, you know, partially for my sake, but also because I've made our listeners listen to me talk about sentimentality a lot, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about the relationship between norm porn and sentimentality.
Yeah, it's interesting because norm porn leads with realism. If you take any like 19th century fiction course, right, we're going to talk about how sentimentality figures into realist narrative. But for the most part, there's supposed to be some form of clear separation of realism as a form of art and sentimentality as a form of cheap popular, you know, engagement, or at least, you know, one that like kind of elicits a certain kind of political, you know, all of this stuff, right? Like kind of political response, melodrama, sentimentality, et cetera, genre stuff versus realism, right? So I think that norm porn very much leads with, because of the kind of pedigree of a project like 30-something, this sort of fetishism of realism. And then it sort of purports to just be depicting real emotion and not sentimentality, right? Even though if you think about it, once you hear the soaring strings and the dramatic guitar plucks of these various series, they are definitely working with some sort of a more contemporary iteration of what we would otherwise describe as sentimentality. So that's what I would just say, is it's a sort of a little bit of a shell game that realism has played with sentimentality for a long time, but that makes its kind of, I don't know, its game more explicit to us as we watch these shows, as you see more and more television aspiring to the condition of art.
Yeah, and still continuously sort of sliding sentimentality in there as part of what makes it so sort of compulsively viewable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gives you a plausible deniability as a viewer to a certain extent. You're just saying, you know, like, I'm watching quality television. You know, I'm watching quality TV. I'm sorry, but it's not like I'm watching Seventh Heaven. I'm watching quality. This is Emmy-nominated shit.
This is serious TV for serious people. Yeah. I'm a serious person.
Yeah, exactly. So that's sort of what it is. It gives you a bit of an alibi at the same time that it's like, oh, actually, you know, it's manipulating you in very similar ways.
Mm.
Karen, can I ask you another question about norm porn?
Sure.
Would you say that norm porn has a particular aesthetic to it?
I would absolutely say so. Well, first of all, I think that it's linked to aesthetic achievement, which I've just sort of been saying. And that's why that many of these shows have like auteurist, you know, kind of framing attached to them. The showrunner becomes an important person. The Sherman Palladinos for Gilmore Girls, Jason Kadams for Parenthood. He also did Friday Night Lights. Zvik and Herskovitz, who did 30-something, they created a brand that continued over into My So-Called Life and other series later. And then you have Dan Fogelman for This Is Us, who's known for his film Crazy Stupid Love, right?
Oh.
So there's definitely, there's a sense of the auteur behind them, that there's a kind of real story being told, like the engine is art and not just, you know, commercial success. That said, there are also certain visual aesthetic signatures of norm porn.
Okay.
There's a slideshow that I show of all of these series with their cast photos, the large sprawling cast, diverse sepia toned. If you look at the font of all of their title cards, it's the same font that I have on the book cover where like part of the title is bold and the other is not bold. So it's sort of like, this is us, 30 something. You know, Gilmore Girls, right? Like Parenthood, right?
We're doing typography. We are artists.
Exactly. And also what I call the kind of aesthetic visual signature of norm porn is the twinkle lit, string light repast in a garden. So it's like dining outdoors with your sprawling intergenerational milieu with like string lights. That is the visual signature of norm porn. And we can go also into the music. I mean, there is like this, the sonic landscape of norm porn, from the plucky lute-like guitars of the 30-something theme song to, you know, all the Sufjan Stevens and This Is Us. And the personnel between these series, it's not just coincidental. Ken Olin, who plays Michael Stedman in 30-something, ends up being a major producer and director on This Is Us decades later. So, and not to mention Gilmore Girls as the firmament of norm porn actors, from Lauren Graham, who ends up being on Parenthood, and Mila Ventimiglia, who ends up being the patriarch on This Is Us, to Todd Lowe is in another series I write about, which is I call the funhouse mirror of norm porn, and that is True Blood. Yeah, so, but there's a lot of people who end up, and including Alexis Bledel, Rory Gilmore. It's not norm porn, but I think that it's meaningful that she ends up as the handmaid of Glenn in the Handmaid's Tale series. And then she goes from being Rory Gilmore from the Land of Stars Hollow, where there is no abortion, to the mutilated handmaid lesbian in The Handmaid's Tale.
I really just want to like start like naming shows that I've watched and be like, is that one? That one? But I won't.
That's
I won't
how
that.
You know it's a good theoretical frame, because it immediately makes you want to like hold it up to everything else that you've seen and see how it makes you see that thing differently. Karen, as you were describing the like paradigmatic scene of norm porn, I realized that like, that is a scene that I have attempted to reproduce in my own actual life so many times.
The twinkle lights?
Because it is one twinkle lights with a sprawling, diverse dinner party in a garden. Like, that's with everybody, right? With a kind of like anthropology-esque table set and everybody passing around like big bowls of food and laughing. Mm-hmm. Like, that still lives in my head as like the aesthetic ideal of living a good life.
Can I show you all an image? And it appears in the True Blood chapter of the book. Mm-hmm. And to describe for your audiences what I'm showing you right now, it's two screen captures. One is from the opening credit sequence to Parenthood, which ran from 2010 through 2015. And the other is the final scene in the series finale of True Blood in 2014. For those of you who can't see it, it's nearly identical. A long table filled with people raising their glasses to a toast with twinkle lights strung up all around them. And I don't know, just curious to hear your reactions to this contrast, because it's very much where I see, you know, True Blood, again, being the funhouse mirror to these shows that traded very much not in fantasy and the gothic, but in realism.
For folks who haven't watched True Blood, it's also like so pornographic. I tried watching it on a train one time and I was so uncomfortable by it's like so much sex. I mean, wonderful, satisfying, raunchy sex, drugs, or like the sort of kind of like drug use, but it's like blood,
a lot of nudity. So seeing how it is reproducing aesthetically what is like a family genre, but is like drawing on those visual cues, which I never would have picked up on.
Mm-hmm.
And which also in turn makes me think about an incredible scene in the series I've been making everybody watch, Deadlock.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a, you know, fantastic Australian sort of limited run murder mystery series, but has this incredible scene of all of these people outdoors enjoying a beautiful meal at a long table under twinkle lights. But it's the scene where you realize that one of the people at that table is a murderer.
Yeah.
And so the thing that strikes me right away is the way that these later representations or these later sort of plays on that twinkle light dinner scene are in part telling you that, like, you should have seen something sinister in the original versions of this. That, like, you should look at these scenes of sort of norm porn pleasure and, like, recognize that a bunch of the people at this table might be murderers, or that there's a violence that underpins this particular kind of pleasure.
And that makes this repast possible, right? And I'll say that one of the things about True Blood and the reason that appears in norm porn is that so much of the conversations of True Blood, if not the action, are about mainstreaming, about what it would mean politically to be normal, about the kind of problematic behind that.
Mm-hmm.
Many people read it as an allegory for marriage equality. In many respects, you know, I wanted to bring out that dimension of it and some of the wonderfully parodic things that series did with the visual signifiers of political campaigns and norm porn, and even the discussions about normalcy that come up in the finale are remarkable because they point to this prevailing, I think, wish in the 2010s, in the U.S. in particular, for all of its sins to be erased and to kind of start over with this more utopian vision of the family.
I think part of what is so interesting about True Blood being a kind of funhouse mirror is that Alan Ball, who is the creator, is coming from 6 Feet Under, which, you know, as you were describing norm porn, I was thinking about 6 Feet Under, and 6 Feet Under feels like there's constant failure of normalcy in that family, right? Because they run a funeral home. And so you have this like kind of classic family, this mother, father, and their three children who are almost all adults. They run a family business, but it's a funeral home. And then the father dies and the teenage daughter is like trying meth and putting a foot in some guy's locker because he did her dirty. And like so much about like these characters throughout the development of the series is them just not fitting into normal suburban life, even though that's what they're supposed to have. So it's so fascinating to see him go from 6 feet under, which is just like about the misery of human existence, and then making this like funhouse mirror version of norm porn. I love it. I absolutely adore this.
I'm glad we found a show that could speak to you, Marcel, for the whole Norm Porn Archive.
I do like it. Sometimes, you know, we do these episodes and I'm like, I've never seen it. I've never heard of it. I've never done it.
I don't know her.
I don't know her. And I feel like I sometimes come across as this person who like, I only consume good things or quality things. And that is fundamentally untrue. I watch so much garbage. I read
Marcel's
so much
a snob.
Garbage. I am not a snob. I'm just not with it.
Okay. Marcel, on the topic of snobbery and the things that we watch and the things that we watch maybe that we're proud of watching and then the things we watch that we feel a little bit less proud of watching. Karen, you talk in the book about norm porn as a form of entertainment that causes queer viewers in particular shame. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about how you're thinking about shame and why it is that queer viewers are drawn to this media that causes us shame, and yet.
Well, it's middlebrow fare, so it's not quite prestige fare. It receives praise from critics, but from really mainstream outlets, right? Mm. So, you know, the thing about queerness is that it pitches its tent around, you know, avant-gardism usually, or the subcultural, or things that, you know, aesthetically are coming up against or counter to the mainstream. And so, of course, there's going to be guilt involved, especially around these depictions of normative arrangements and kind of the glorification of them, the re-glorification of them. Unless you are a homonormative viewer, right? It's going to kind of run counter to a sense of queer radicalism or queer politics or queer aesthetic judgment, which is supposed to be, you know, exposing the vagaries of middling middlebrow fare. And, you know, the reason I think that queer viewers and others are drawn to this is that the amount of despair and suffering and dysregulation that people experience in their everyday realist lives, right, as well as in the kind of broader political sphere or broader political environment, pushes us towards some sense of comfort at some point, or some sense of trying to soothe ourselves. I say that norm porn is thick with the guilt of assimilation, in part because what it plays out for us is this narrative about a new normal that everyone was talking about in the cultural sphere around the 2010s onward, in Obama's second term in office, and the sense that there was just going to be continuity. Of course, we knew what the enemy was going to be. It was going to be neoliberal assimilation and all of that, you know, the kind of typical engine of late stage capitalism, et cetera. But we had no idea how much worse, or maybe we did have an idea, but like to see the worst case scenarios materialize became something that we had to grapple with in a certain way and said, oh shit, actually, that part of it, this compromise aspect of it, you know, it's something that we will never achieve, but it's also something that we might actually lose, right? Amidst all of this.
I would like to keep talking about norm porn forever, but I think that it's time to articulate a thesis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
In our final segment, we can see Hannah bring together the history of our object of study and our theoretical framework to articulate a thesis statement that we then get to pick apart.
Get ready, this is cribbing heavily from Kieran's book.
Ooh.
The return of Gilmore Girls to our screens in 2016 via the much-anticipated A Year in the Life miniseries became a collective disappointment, not only for the way the final four words of the show teased for years by show creator Amy Sherman-Palladino felt like a betrayal of the characters we had grown to love, but also for how the structural limitations of the show's post-feminist politics were thrown into stark relief by Hillary Clinton's loss of the U.S. presidential race to Donald Trump. Ironically, this disappointment did little to undermine the comfort-viewing popularity of Gilmore Girls for feminist and queer viewers who were drawn to the contained normalcy of Stars Hollow as a space in which the bourgeois everyday was elevated to the status of drama and the real costs of political events constantly brushed off screen. But Gilmore Girls reminds us that the fantasy of the normal is impossible without certain sacrifices, which are most notably born in the show by women of color. In this essay,
need to talk about Lane Kim. We need to talk about Lane Kim because, you know, we talked a little bit about Suki St. James and the reproductive burden she carried, but Lane was done dirty. And it's really something that the fandom demands we talk about.
Stop. Both of you, I need you to remind me who Lane Kim is. I know it's the best friend, but like, tell me more. Pretend I've never seen this show.
All right, fine. Okay, so Lane Kim is Rory's best friend. And, you know, most fresh in my mind is her arc in the early seasons right now, because that's what I've been rewatching, which is that she is being raised by quite a strict immigrant mother, Mrs. Kim, who, you know, insists that she dress in conservative ways and go to church regularly and eat only very healthy foods and date only young Korean American men with promising futures. And meanwhile, Lane wants to like eat Snickers bars and listen to rock music and gets crushes on white boys. And so Lane is sort of a counter to a lot of the freedoms that we see Rory enjoying via the mother who is raising her. And in that sense, you know, also her relationship with her mother is often sort of the foil to Rory's relationship with Lorelai. But Karen, do you want to talk a little more about...
Just I want to underscore that Mrs. Kim is a Seventh-day Adventist. So part of the junk food thing is also that there's no space to eat anything but like that dense bread that purportedly like you have to eat as a Seventh-day Adventist and other things like that.
And so much tofu.
Yeah, so it's sort of like, it's not even like that they have an immigrant diet. It's that they have this really strict religious diet. Also, like Lane Kim has a father who we never see. And it's sort of like, what's going on with that as well? It's just sort of like the kind of disappearance of, you know, the kind of larger family unit. There's an exact replication of the Lorelai Rory dyad.
Yeah. And then there's this, you know, like part of the anxiety through the early years of the show is, you know, will Rory get pregnant at 16 like her mother did? Like, will she, you know, follow the path that her mother did? But instead, the person who gets pregnant at a very early age in a kind of life-ruining way is Lane. She very frequently features on, like, you know, feminist listicles that are like, you know, 10 TV characters whose lives would have been improved by abortion. Like, it's really like the impossibility of abortion within the logic of the show is evident there in, obviously, in Lorelai's past, but screams all the more loudly in Lane's experience of getting accidentally pregnant on her honeymoon after having terrible sex one time. And heartbreakingly, we never get to hear about her having good sex.
Well, first of all, there's a whole thing about blaming Mexican condoms in the scene where Lane reveals that she's pregnant to Rory. And Rory's first response is not, well, you don't need to have the baby, but it's like, you'd make a great mom. Like, that's the dialogue. It's not even on the table. The same episode that Lane announces her pregnancy, we get flashbacks to Lorelai finding out she's pregnant and her parents fighting with the baby daddy's parents, right? And the baby daddy's parents just say, well, you know, she can fix this or something like that. And Emily Gilmore, Lorelai's mom, is like, get those words out of your mouth. It was immediately shut down. And that's, you know, and Rory replicates that in the conversation she has with Lane. And there's some funny stuff about Britney Spears being a mom or what have you that they throw into the dialogue to try to lighten it up. But there really is never do you need support? Do you need help? Like, you're not ready to have this kid, these kids. It ends up being not only one child, but is it twins or triplets or what have you?
It's twins.
Yeah, twins. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, my cat objects to all of that.
Yeah,
he's furious. Marcel, you had a question.
Why is Lane married?
Because she's Christian. Lane moves in with her bandmates, and she is getting ready to pursue her musical career. But, you know, obviously she and her paramour, who is also in the band, played by Todd Lowe, who happens to also end up in True Blood. Zach is his name. Zach Van Gerbig. Okay, he's got a silly dweeby white boy name. and you know, they're getting ready to essentially, you know, consummate their relish when Lane gets Mrs. Kim's mores popping into her head just as she's about to cross the threshold into independence, womanhood, etc. She realizes she can't have sex unless she gets married. And so that becomes the condition for her losing her virginity. And in the act of losing her virginity, she then becomes saddled with twins, which is just like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
In a footnote to norm porn, though, I talk about how in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, there is an Asian character who gets pregnant and who may be reparations for Lane Kim insofar as she doesn't, spoiler alert, end up having to keep the kid. And so she gets to have the promise of her life as a doctor, perhaps fulfilled. That all happens off screen. We don't see any of that.
Yeah.
But I think that that's a bit of like a light cop out because the violence to Lane was so intense.
Oh, I mean, it makes me think too about like the storyline on Grey's Anatomy when Sandra Oh's character, Christina, gets pregnant. And the way that like mainstream TV will brush off the problem of abortion through a miscarriage. So like a character who would like 100% have an abortion, instead they have that character miscarry and then grieve the miscarriage, and then it lets the show have it both ways. I think that's the famous Sedate Me scene.
Yes.
A tour de force. I love Sandra Oh.
If everybody wonders why we lost abortion rights in the United States, just think about like the arc of television leading up to the Dobbs decision.
Truly, like just the ongoing unspeakability of abortion through decades of it being legal, and yet still something that can't be present. You know, I think of Juno, which I love, but I remember one of my best friends at the time who was working for Planned Parenthood Ottawa and was like really like passionately engaged in abortion provision, being like, I cannot watch this movie. Like, I got to the scene where she's at the abortion clinic and it's so horrible. Like, it's such a bleak, miserable space. And she so quickly changes her mind. And she was like, you know, that's the kind of representation of abortion that makes it imaginatively impossible for young people. And that's, you know, that's one where abortion's actually spoken, let alone, you know, the Gilmore Girls of the world, where that's what I was watching when I was 15, 16, 17. And the fact that one, motherhood is held up as a kind of feminist ideal, that like it is how Lorelai has like liberated herself from her conservative family and built a new life for herself. And that life is like quirky and interesting and artistic. And that was facilitated through having a child. And then the fact that like for any other character, it's just never even offered as a possibility. Like, it really does reshape the imaginative possibilities of what you do if you are accidentally pregnant. Karen, can we round out this conversation by maybe talking about the way that Lane's marriage to Zach and then very young procreation with him sort of like locks her in Stars Hollow, whereas Rory's boyfriends take her further and further away from Stars Hollow?
Yeah. Zach and Lane are the sort of memento mori of the memento mori of what would have happened if Rory stuck with Dean to a certain extent and didn't kind of branch off into bad boys. And in fact, you know, the thing is, Lane is the one who's supposed to travel the world, who's supposed to be a musician on tour, right? All Rory needs, because she wants to be a writer, is a room of her own to a certain extent. And Lane's ambition is to tour, to be in a band, to be a rock star. Yeah, to get to see many things beyond Stars Hollow and many things beyond the really insular world of Seventh-day Adventism that Mrs. Kim has established for her. But what ends up happening, of course, is Rory, even though she goes to Yale, which is not very far away from Stars Hollow, apparently, she ends up hooking up with a very wealthy son of a media mogul while in college. And that attachment lasts and apparently endures. Sure, they kind of, you know, break up when the regular series ends. Because, you know, we want to see Rory be an independent woman. She actually ends up touring the country on the Obama campaign bus as the series ends, covering the Obama campaign for an online news magazine or maybe Politico or something like that. And then, you know, and then when we revisit her narrative in A Year in the Life in 2016, the Gilmore Girls reunion special on Netflix that happens over four seasons, summer, winter, fall, spring, we find out that she's still attached to Logan, and that involves like international bonking in you know, the UK and other parts. So
yeah, so she gets to travel the world and bonk a terrible wasp, and Lane's stuck in Stars Hollow forever.
And Rory's on again, off again, douchey, rich dude is named Logan Huntsberger.
Yeah. No.
Yes.
Anyway. You guys. Material Girls is a Witch Please production and is distributed by Acast. Why don't you grab an obviously empty coffee cup and head on over to ohwitchplease.ca to check out the rest of our episodes, as well as transcripts, reading lists, and merch. We have an excellent newsletter at ohwitchplease.substack.com and an even better Patreon at patreon.com/ohwitchplease. And also, we're on Instagram, X, and Threads at ohwitchplease, and on TikTok at Oh, Witch Please Pod. Karen, where can people find out more about your work?
You can find me at KarenTongson.org, where you can link to a lot of my work. You can also purchase my books there, especially Norm Porn, which I encourage you to purchase on your independent bookstore platforms or in person at your favorite local bookstore. I'm active on Instagram at Tongsonator, and I'm still around despite all of the kind of wicked changes at the platform formerly known as Twitter, X, as well as Threads and Blue Sky at Inland Emperor.
Amazing. Thanks to Auto Syndicate for the use of our theme song, Shopping Mall. And of course, thanks to the whole Witch Please Productions team, our transcriber, Ruth Ormiston, our digital content coordinator, Gabby Iori, our social media manager and marketing designer, Zoe Mix, and our executive producer, Hannah Rehack, aka Coach.
At the end of every episode, we will thank everyone who has joined our Patreon or boosted their tier to help make our work possible. Our enormous gratitude goes out to Grace, Sarah R., Sarah W., Anna, Maria L.
Oh my God, that's Lucia's sister. Thanks, Maria.
Aw. Leo, Sarah H., and Alexandra M.
We'll be back next episode to tackle another piece of pop culture through a whole new theoretical lens. But until then,
later, Stars Hollow neighbors.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.